Okay, good morning, members. Good morning, members. I'll call the tax committee to order, and we really want to get to the governor's proposal today and get the public testimony. So we're going to, I saw the commissioner come in, except I don't see him now. There he is. I'm here. Ah, oh, you're not excited to sell the governor's budget to us? Come on. Welcome, Commissioner. We want to, and members, I did talk to the commissioner after last meeting. We've had two really good, healthy discussions, two full committees so far on this whole concept of should we have business tax cuts now or not, and where should they go. And so I think we've had public testifiers waiting in the last minute. We want to hear from them today. So we're going to try to have the commissioner, finish his presentation of everything and the changes. I think it's probably the best way. And then take questions from the commissioner at the end so we can, because we haven't even touched on the property tax yet, which is big. And then we'll get to the public testimony. We want to get that all done and adjourn on time. So, Rep. Mallory.
Madam Chair, I just wondered if that was a pre-science or something when you said governor, the way he's moving around to different positions, he knows all the state governments, so I just wondered if he was actually intending to move there next.
Commissioner, what's wrong?
Nothing.
Well, you look like you got ticked and you're down. You want to tell us about the Senate? What happened? We want to know.
We had a really good discussion. That Senate committee can be intimidating at times. You got Representative Ress, former taxpayers on it now, and you got Senator Pogomil, former taxpayer on it, and you got the taxpayer in the box. And you got, so it's always a good discussion, but rather intense.
So to the commissioner, for the record, just endorsed the House Tax Committee. Thanks for that. Representative Carlson. Okay, so Commissioner, what page are we on? Page 8 or 9 now? Or
I
what
think
we're
right, Madam President. We're on page 8.
Page 8. It's this one.
Page capital.
And then we are going to, when you're done, well, we will have Ms. Templin walk through the money item. Let everyone see on the spreadsheet what the governor's proposal costs. Then we'll go to public testimony. Okay, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ward. I am from the Department of Revenue. And on page 8 is the annual investment credit that the governor has proposed in the past.
Oh, excuse me. Commissioner, can you use the mic? Can you get it over? There we go.
Is that better?
Appreciate that.
Page 8 is the Angel Investment Credit, and also another program the governor is advocating for called the Small Business Investment Act. I think some folks have referred to it as the CAPCO program. Not new to legislature last year, there was a vehicle that included a provision like this. The early Angel Investment Credit is very similar to what we proposed last year, where there would be certified investors who would get a tax credit in order to invest in targeted early stage investment. The primary architect of these two proposals is the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I know that Mr. Ross is just here another, so if there's detailed questions about that proposal, they are in a better position to answer those. They've worked hard on this. I think every year it's been introduced, we think it's been improved upon, and so I think it's a better vehicle than it was in the past. But it really, I think it's an acknowledgement that there is a gap in early stage investment that maybe the state can play a role in trying to fill. And these two proposals are an attempt to address that investment gap. On the next page is,
excuse me, Commissioner, Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, in a different committee yesterday to a different commissioner, there was a question on the Angel Investment Credit around why it didn't show up until 2012. And I'm wondering if you, I'm sure that question would probably come out of this committee today as well, so I thought you might touch on that while we're on the topic.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's my understanding it's a timing issue in that it'll take a while for these investment funds to be certified by DEED and the Department of Commerce. It'll take a while for them to identify eligible investments. And there was some indication that we have a very deep budget crisis that we have to address. That's important to get this online, but at the same time, we need to be mindful of the deficit we have. So I think it was a dual consideration. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Mark Loftus from DEED.
In both cases, the credits are deferred, when the credit can be taken, is deferred out until the third year, 2012. And we expect the investments will begin to occur immediately. But the individual or the group that qualifies for the credit would not take it until several years out. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that we are trying to induce investment to occur without having to give the credit right away. In both cases, we think are a very good sense that the people that want to make those investments will make them, even if they get a credit out several years. And frankly, we're also trying to avoid a hit on the budget in 10 and 11. Mm-hmm. So if we can, the longer we can defer a credit, the better off we can all be. The net present value of the investment returned to the state is greater if the credit is deferred. Now, it's only deferred a couple of years out because within the administration, the discussion wanted to make it clear that we are not deferred credits so far out that we can't keep track of them. So I think that's a fair characterization of our...
Okay, thank you. Mr. Lopez, since you're here, may I just ask, I don't think I've ever talked to you about this personally, but I think we probably are aware of each other's opposite positions maybe on this particular proposal, because there have been versions over time, and as was stated, they've changed. Can you tell me what the argument is from Deed, and maybe it's for Commissioner Inez. If the state, through the taxpayers, are going to put up 25% of the equity here in this event investment, or put up 25% of the money for these firms, why shouldn't the taxpayer get a stake in that equity? I mean, the benefits don't accrue. We're asking taxpayers to pay for it, and then we don't get the return. And can you give me the argument why? It isn't one I agree with, but I'd like to just hear the argument. I guess it's jobs, but maybe you can help me understand why we'd want to do this.
Madam Chair, you're right. It is a jobs orientation. If we look at it, it really in two perspectives. The job creation credit is a focused on small investments, small companies. The Rainforest Capital Group, that's been the kind of the prototype for this effort, has invested in total $77 million in their companies that they have assisted by their funds. 2,200 jobs have been created in those companies, 55 different companies. So it is a job creation focus. It's not the return to the taxpayers is the job creation, presuming that occurred. However, on the second part, the Small Business Investment Tax Credit, that's the one that the insurance companies would invest into these small business investment firms who would make the investments. We do have a portion of the proposal that, to the extent that there are returns over a certain level, that the state would have return brought back to it to be invested in additional venture capital funds like the angel credits, or even in venues like incubator programs, incubator for new technology. So we do have a sense that in that portion, if there are excessive returns, or not excessive, but returns above a certain level, that we would get a taxpayer return to that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask either of the gentlemen what I'm thinking of as the Chair's question, which is, why do this as a tax credit? Why not a grant program? I'm not necessarily directing this to Mr. Loftus, but the grant program presumably would be run through Deed. Maybe more precise, more finely grained a question would be, what would be the differences in investor and business owner behavior from a tax credit versus from some sort of a grant program?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, a couple of answers to that. One is that as a state's department, we often get criticized with picking winners and losers. And frankly, on investing in early stage companies, we are not qualified to do that. We believe, though, that within the capital markets, the venture capital markets, whether angel credits or a little later stage credits, they are much better positioned to make those decisions. So if you said, well, let's give Deed a grant program for $12 million as opposed to tax credits, I'm not sure if we would be in the best position to make those investments. We're trying to help individual investors, small but accredited, fairly high income or net worth people, be able to make those investments by pooling their understanding of what it takes to make investments, how to exit a company with their investment, and so forth. And it hasn't seemed to us that we are in a position to make that.
And Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I think the point that Mark made is a good one. I think there's always that tension over at Deed about where their core competency is, where our core competency was, and it really is not in making investment decisions. And so I think having these certified investors, these certified funds, who that is their expertise, that's what they do for a living. The folks at Deed, well-intentioned, do a lot of great things over at job training, others, you know, provide loan programs. It just is not the core competency of Deed to make these kind of very sophisticated investment decisions about where to put money. So I think it's helpful to have these certified investment networks. The credit is 60%, and there's always debate about what that tipping point is to make them, incent them enough to take these investments that normally probably wouldn't take. I mean, we're really subsidizing the investment with this credit. And some proposals you'll see are, I think, at 80%. We think the tipping point maybe should be 60%. So, you know, and I think the other thing about this program, the Small Business Investment Act, is that it's not a new out-of-the-box program. A number of states and large states like New York and Texas have utilized this program. They've reauthorized it. There's been improvement of the program over time because there's been some issues with the program when it first came out, was first introduced and first test-driven by some of the states. But many of the states have gone back and reauthorized this program. And I think we've improved upon it. We've learned from their mistakes about what works and what doesn't work, where the tipping point is as far as how robust the tax credit has to be. So I think it has a track record. And I think that's also helpful. We're not uncharted territory here. It has a track record, and we've learned from some of the mistakes that have been made in other states.
Thank you.
Commissioner, I think what's happening in this discussion, I noticed it yesterday too, is all of these keep getting intertwined in the discussion. So I think part of the answer we just heard was actually related to the reinvestment tax credit, not the angel investor credit.
Okay.
And they all kind of function differently. And I guess, you know, we're back to, did we talk about them all at once or separately? Remember, these are all different things that do different things for different taxpayers. So I think it's hard to think about them this way, but if the legislature wants to propose any of them, we probably need to think about them individually. And we do have the issue now with the angel investor credit, in my mind, where we don't have an incentive for out-of-state capital. Is that right in the angel investor credit program? So it would, if you don't have a Minnesota liability, you're not helped. Mr. Loftus?
Madam Chair is correct.
Okay, so these are all kind of different things doing different things, and it's hard for us to keep them all straight, but Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, two questions. One is actually a clarification. I could infer from some of the questions and maybe even the answers that the state is actually somehow funding these investors' investments, and what we're really doing is offering them a tax credit against the income they would realize from those investments. Is that, I just want to make sure I'm right on that. I think there's a huge difference conceptually for people to think that the state is somehow investing in these companies. We're not. We're just saying if you invest and are successful, we will grant you that kind of a credit against the tax you would be paying on that investment.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, that's correct. It's a way to help induce others to invest in ways that they're not doing it now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How does this compare to neighboring states? My understanding is that maybe Wisconsin has a similar program, and this is in part perhaps to be competitive with some of our regional neighbors.
Mr. Loftus.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, if the angel tax credit, as it's described, the job creation investment tax credit, is very much similar to the Wisconsin program, which is, I think, a $25,000 tax credit, or 25% to $25,000 also. It differs, and other states have had similar early stage capital programs. It differs in that we are also focusing on what we think is the best practice that's been kind of fostered in Minnesota. The Rainforest Capital Group is an embodiment of a principle that small investors may have done well. They might be a physician or an accountant or a professional person. They have high income or high net worth. They don't necessarily have the acumen to make investments on their own. So it creates a small regional fund approach to help them pool that. And that's different from Wisconsin's and I think most other states. But we have also built into this proposal the possibility that individuals, like the Wisconsin network, Wisconsin model, could be eligible as well. So we're trying to mix the regional approach to help people who may not know how to invest in companies along with individuals who do, you know, combining those. And in testimony today, I think you probably will hear a question about why we have a regional approach, and we think it's in part due to that fact that individuals by themselves might not know how to do it.
Okay. And may I just... So the difficult subject in this room, and testifiers would now, who are waiting to talk on these things, will disagree with me. So I just want to get in on the record here. Representative Downey's comment of, you know, this really isn't costing the taxpayers, I would just profoundly disagree with that. It is not a partisan issue here. I mean, I want people to just think about this for a minute. Representative Downey can be right in what he said, and I can be right. This is not him versus me. It's kind of thinking back to sort of economics 101. We often hear people tell us, if it's a minus off our liability, it doesn't cost anybody anything. It's though but for, if we weren't coming anyhow, you wouldn't get the money anyhow, so it's really not costing anybody anything. And that's just not accurate in this committee, in the sense that there is a cost to losses in government services. These are costs to everybody in the economy as well. So to do something like this, and I know Wisconsin and others have very seductive programs that impress people, and it does cost something, and it either costs all other taxpayers in the system having to pay more because this taxpayer is now paying less, or if we say we don't want all other taxpayers in the system, both individual, corporate, and anything else, to pay for that, we're going to cut something the government now does. So there absolutely is a cost, either in reduced services somewhere else in the K-12 budget or health and human, or other taxpayers pay more to maintain the current level of government services. So I just think and Commissioner, you can disagree with me on that. Feel free, please. But I have to put it out there because it's very seductive when legislators hear these things don't cost anything. They absolutely, for state budgeting purposes, cost things. And they cost taxpayers. That's who they cost. Commissioner?
And Madam Chair, I wouldn't disagree with anything you said. In fact, our change page clearly shows that there's a cost to the general fund for each one of these provisions. So we're very transparent about that. We think the net benefit to the state, though, justifies that cost. Otherwise, we wouldn't be proposing it. So I'll stipulate right now, there is a cost to these provisions.
And I'll give a chance for Representative Downey to respond, because I think Representative Downey and I aren't really disagreeing so much. It's sort of... You know, what are you thinking about? Are you talking about the individual payor into the system or the larger economy of the whole state? And it may be that you decide that the cost to all other taxpayers or the cost of reduced service are worth this tax benefit. If they're, you know, in my opinion, if it didn't cost anything, they wouldn't need to be here. And I do think the previous testimony that, you know, that government's bad at this. You're absolutely right, Mr. Loftus and Commissioner. Government should not make these decisions. We are no good at this. We don't know how to pick winners. And we're not investors, and government fails at this over and over and over. And so I agree. We wouldn't want the government doing this. But there's ways to get around that in a grant program. But we also, if we're going to ask taxpayers for money, they should get the benefit, too. So I agree. The business community is much better at doing this than government is, and I'd like them separated, personally, but Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think in part I'm just trying to clarify semantics. The original question asked is why don't we show any kind of a hit to the general fund until year three of the program, and then I heard other comments that somehow the state was actually making investments, and the reality is this tax credit never materializes unless an investor makes an investment and earns income from that investment, unless I'm understanding the program wrong.
Well, if I may, let's have Mr. Michael...
Then that's the point I'm trying to clarify,
right.
To understand
and
the mechanics of it.
And I think this is really good, Representative Downey, because I think it's hard for us to all make decisions together if we're all kind of talking in different lingo, and I know everything's loaded around here, as you've probably guessed. Well, yesterday when I said government and everybody else went, taxpayers, and I meant the same thing. But maybe if we have, you know, our staff who was able to separate all these loaded terms. So I appreciate you bringing it up. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's hard to know exactly how this is going to work without seeing the bill language, but based on prior proposals and based on the Small Business Investment Tax Credit Bill, which has been introduced, the way this would work, basically the delay comes because there's a delay in when you can claim the credit in the tax year that you can claim the credit. But if you make one of these angel investments, qualifying angel investments, just to take that as an example, let's say you make a $10,000 investment, you get a 25% credit for that investment. So you could reduce your taxes by $2,500. Now, if that investment turns out to be a bad investment and it generates no return, goes to zero, because they can't get venture capital, they can't fund it, that does not affect the fact that you can reduce your tax on your wage or other income by $2,500. If it turns out to be wildly successful and your $10,000 investment goes to $100,000, then there's a capital gain tax on that when you sell it, and the state would, you know, realize that 7.85% tax on that capital gain. But even though I think the chair was making the point that, well, in effect, because you got $2,500 off of your investment, the state sort of de facto like putting in $2,500,
right,
and it doesn't get a return from that. It gets a return either in expanded jobs in the state for people that pay taxes or in the capital gain tax. And that's also true of the small business investment tax credit. There is a 60% credit that reduces the premiums tax. And again, it's not dependent upon whether that investment's successful or not. It reduces your upfront cost of the investment. But to save the budget cost, they say, well, taxpayer, you can't claim that credit until a couple tax years later. So I hope that clears up some of the...
Thank you. That's an important distinction, and I was not aware that that was the way the program worked. So
thank you. Appreciate that. Can we just go to a very important announcement that Representative West is going to make now?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I ask for the committee's indulgence to introduce the 9th through 12th grade students from Humboldt Senior High and my town of St. Paul. And students, I know this sounds pretty dry right now, but we are talking about some pretty significant things of revenue. This is Commissioner of Revenue sitting right here. And we're talking about how we raise revenue, if we raise revenue, and whether or not your class sizes are too big, or whether you get access to a guidance counselor, or things like that. So, in honor, Madam Chair, I know I editorialize a little bit, but with your permission, I'd ask the members to welcome the students from Humboldt.
Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. We really do appreciate it. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I had a question that got satisfied by Representative Downey and the Commissioner and Esquire, but I do have a comment. I have a guy that I know as a friend. He works in an angel investment firm. That's what he does. He travels all. He lives in Minnesota. He travels all around the country, and he manages money, lots of money. And this is money coming from private individuals. And he has lamented and shared with me about his frustration about not being able to do business in Minnesota. Not because he's prohibited from it, but because the money does not want to be here because we don't have these sorts of things in place, this type of thing. Because you can go other places and they have a better opportunity to invest. Because sometimes they do lose money. That's why they need this type of investment to be able to satisfy them. Sometimes they do very well, and obviously he gets paid when they do very well. But sometimes when they invest, because again, this is venture capital. Venture by its nature is high return, but it's high return because you can also lose money. And the bottom line is, he's frustrated because in Minnesota, we don't have the kind of climate where they can take this money and invest. And as he told me, he said, we build businesses. We get an idea from somebody, we put the money in to get the business up and going, and sometimes they go and sometimes they don't. But there are other places in this country, in the United States, where they can go and have this sort of investment, and that's where that cash goes. And we're talking about millions of dollars. We're not talking about a $10,000 investment from me or from you, Madam Chair. We're talking about millions of dollars to help get these things going. And so I would not disagree with the fact that this does cost money, but it's the before. It costs money if they come here and if they make the investment. Our decision is that an investment for us in that money that we're spending? If they don't come here, if they don't make the investment, we don't spend it, therefore we have no investment to worry about. But if we want the capital to be here to help grow businesses, there's a cost to that if you're going to play. If you're going to play with the big boys, you've got to get off the porch. And, you know, I think that's kind of what this is. So I don't disagree with you, Madam Chair, in terms of the cost. There is. But I think we have to think about the but-for. Whether it's on income or whether it's on making the investment to begin with, it's still a but-for argument. And that's debatable. We understand that. But that's just a personal experience that I share with an individual that is frustrated because he would like to see Minnesota have policies in place that would allow him, in the best interest of the people he works for, to try to do business in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Demeron. Representative Tolbert.
Madam Chair, some of my questions have been answered by Mr. Michael, but it does seem that venture capitals are that. They're a venture capital, and I want to make big on it, so I make an investment. And it looks like on this particular thing, if I don't make big, I'm protected. If I make big, I'm protected a little bit.
That's right.
It's an encouragement for me to make big. And, right. And I understand also in some of the other committees that this has been discussed on venture capital, and some of that's driven by, not by money so much, but policy such as openness, particularly as it relates to the University of Minnesota. And some of their business ideas, their discoveries that we want to be able to transfer into to the business, but we have an open policy. And sometimes their records have to be open because it's an investment. So it's more than just the money, I think, as well. But my question or clarification, I think Mr. Michael said that if I invest as a venture capital in this and I lose, the state less money. If I make, the state may get money. If I make big, the state gets some money. But I understand it's an incentive. The best thing we could do is to have business make the decision on a business basis and not on it because some other state is doing an incentive. And that's what I hear my colleagues across the aisle say, let business make the decision. Well, let business make the decision. Take the risk, make the high reward. And that we shouldn't have any state have this kind of program.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
I'm trying to understand the timing of it when the commissioner could maybe walk us through. Because the dollars don't really become available then until 12 or 13. So if someone makes the investment in 10 or 11, does that carry forward so that they would get the credit in 12? And the reason I raised that question, I'd like you to comment on it, is if that credit isn't available until 12 and 13 and beyond, I think up until 15 and 13, right? What prevents me from wanting to delay my investment, being that I want to create jobs until 12 and 13, and I know there's a reference to holding it for 4 years, but you can watch them through that timeline in terms of when you would make the investment and when you would qualify.
Yeah. Okay. And if you want Mr. Michael to kind of go through it in very darn detail, you can take Mr. Yes. Michael here too. But Commissioner, Mr. Lotsis?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, we will be certifying these investments each year as they come in. So, for instance, with the angel investments, the smaller of the $12 million program, we'll be certifying up to $3 million per year, and then those credits, and that would be against investments that would be, in effect, $12 million total at the 25% level. Those investments would be made as they are held for, have to be held in those companies for a three-year period. They would be able to start taking those credits in year 12. So in fiscal year 11, we would also be awarding another $3 million in credits against $12 million of investment, hopefully. And in 2013, they would start to take those credits. So it would be staggered over time that those credits would be available based on investment when they had made it. So to hold it for several years after we certify them as having made an investment. Is that
incredible?
So Madam Chair, that I understand that if I make it in 10 or 11, and then it, 3 years later, it begins to, I get the credit. So if I make it in 12,
that's right.
When do I start to get the credit? 3 years later?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt and Dietrich. Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. A couple questions, and Representative Carlson kind of led to my first one, but we just heard a couple weeks ago from the Budget Trends Commission about budgeting and looking at things and not creating time bombs into the future. And I'm looking at the Angel program start, you know, it's 12.5 a year. And then on the small business investment, you've got a price tag of $38 million a year that doesn't start till 2012 and later. Well, I should say, is that per year? First of all, a question, is that $38 million on the small business, is that per year, or is that total funding that you would see for that program?
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, these numbers are confusing because the $12.5 million that you see at the top of the page is a composite of each year of the $3 million in the Angel Investment Program and $9.5 million per year in the Small Business Investment Program. So when you see $38 million at the bottom paragraph, that's 4 years times $9.5 million a year.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So my understanding, this would go through 2015 then, the funding. It starts in 2012 and go for 4 years.
That's correct.
Okay. So, I mean, that's one concern, Madam Chair, is, you know, when we're looking at things and it's not even applying to this biennium and we're going to have this obligation down the road. The second concern I have, or just a question maybe on all of the programs, is that, you know, even in the small business one, we're looking at a 60% tax credit, which is basically us putting about 60% of an equity into this. And so that's a pretty good risk on the state part, and in what Representative Lucheski was saying, we're not necessarily on this investment, we may or may not get some return, but we have this risk. We also have a finite amount of dollars in the budget, which means anything we spend on this is going to compromise or produce cuts either in local government aid, in larger classroom sizes, in health care, and that type of thing. I mean, we have some really serious problems. So the question is, with these dollars going into these various economic programs, what is going to be the benchmark? How are we as a state, when we put up this risk and we compromise other programs to fund this, what are we going to say, we've hit this and we now have succeeded. We met what we wanted to do. So what is going to be the benchmark? How are we going to know that taxpayers in the state receive proper value for these dollars? I mean, is it going to be job creation? Is it going to be capital investment? What have we set as a goal to say, this investment, we now met the goal? What is that goal that we're trying to achieve?
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, I think there'll be multiple metrics, but I think the ultimate one is job creation of high quality jobs. You know, this is really focused at filling a gap, a capital investment gap that currently exists. Whether 60% is the right is the right tipping point for to make that credit enough of an incentive to influence these kind of decisions. I think you'll hear some testimony that the 60% is too low. We think that is the tipping point, but back to your point, the metric is going to be ultimately job creation and quality jobs. You know, this isn't we're not trying to create minimum wage type jobs, but these are quality jobs. And we think these investors have the acumen to make kind of those decisions, and we're convinced over the long haul that's going to be the ultimate metric for whether this works or not. And we've looked at what other states have done, and in all honesty, it's been more of a success than not. And some states have really improved on each time they've reauthorized. They've kind of made it a tighter program, more robust program, more accountability in the program, more transparency. I think some of the early versions weren't as transparent as they needed to be. There was the possibility that these fund managers would benefit too much. There's limitations in our bill about that. They would hold on to the credits indefinitely. Now they under our bill, they have to meter out the credits over time. They just can't keep them and wait, you know. So we've done our best to take the best of all the other characteristics from the SBIA that's been, you know, test-driven around the country. But the ultimate, this is a job creation strategy, and we're trying to pull as many levers as we can with the angel investment and the SBIA. Can we guarantee with 100% certainty that this will ultimately be a success and we'll have this huge generation of jobs? No, we can't. But it's been successful in other states. Other states have been much more aggressive about it. We're talking about $100 million authorization, $200 million authorization, 80% tax credit. So we've dialed back a little bit, but we think it has some real merit. and over the long haul, it will create jobs. And ultimately, maybe we'll create the next Medtronic.
One quick follow-up.
Yes, please,
Mr. Marco. Thank you, and I appreciate that, Commissioner. And, you know, President Obama has said in his stimulus package he would like to either create or save, I think it's 4 million jobs. And he may or may not get there, but he has set a goal. He kind of puts himself out there. But the American people, and we can look at that later on and say, did he hit that or not? And I guess I would feel more comfortable if the governor had put out, okay, this is the number of jobs we either want to save or create, and that's what we'll do with this. And you know, you may or may not hit that, but at least we can have something to measure on, and I think the taxpayer deserves that type of accountability also, and I don't know if there is a number out there if you're looking at something.
Madam Chair, Representative Marcourt, at this time, it doesn't sound like they've really done it. I think some of the background information I've seen is some of the other states have tried to calculate what the job creation, the capital investment that can be attributable to this tool. And we can go back and look at that. But we did kick the tires on this quite a bit. And it's something that's been vetted the last couple of years and talked about. Do we absolutely have it right? I don't know.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Marco, if I could add.
Yes,
we've asked our research staff in Inside Deed to do an assessment of these levels of investment using the modeling programs that we have available to us to estimate what that might mean in terms of projected job creation and further investment, both direct and indirect. And those are standard, nationally recognized models. I don't have those today, but we'll, in the course of the discussion here, we'll provide that as we have it.
So. Okay, to that point, Representative Carlson and Dietrich Loeffler-Lesch. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, Director Marquardt's mind to be able to follow up on my earlier question when he referenced the total amount of 50 minutes. And I'm just trying to see how this carries forward in terms of future obligations. What happens if I make that investment then in 2014 or 15? Did that carry forward into those future biennium and then that 50 minutes? By your math, the reference was how much per year it would not be covered. There would be an obligation beyond 2015 if I made that investment within that window.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that is correct. That's correct. There would be an obligation in the out year. But it's capped at $38 million, the total universe of credits that would be ever metered out. So $38 million is the total amount under the SBIA program.
I came in with an investment opportunity in 2014, and the $38 million was gone. They would just simply say, well, that is no longer available.
That is correct.
So there is an absolute gap there.
Thank you. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, I'll be very brief. Since Representative Rue just came in, I didn't want to explain the situation of her constituent, but she introduced, when Deed had that economic fair downstairs at the Capitol, Representative Rue dragged me along because one of her constituents was going to be there. And I do have to say that her constituents basically reiterated what Representative Demmer was saying about that other states are creating a very lucrative situation in their state to attract and businesses to start up in their state. And so I think that that is a major issue. But what I would, my request would be, Commissioner, is just so that we don't talk about that in vague terms, could you put that on some sort of like spreadsheet or something as to some what some of the other states are doing, and at the end of a given time, what kind of investments they are going to be making so that we can weigh ourselves against some other states in more quantitative type terms?
Madam Chair, Representative, we'd be happy to do that. With Deed and Revenue together, we can put together a spreadsheet that kind of gives the lay of the land.
Yes.
But what other states are doing in these areas?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, it seems to me like the first job development here is in 20 separate funds, and that may be the only assurance that we actually have new jobs generated. And I'm intrigued by the concept of why we need 20 across the state just to fuel more regional competition rather than partnership. And I also think like we're kind of back at the beginning of like when cities and counties first wanted to do development assistance to businesses.
Right.
And at first it was to overcome disadvantages. You know, you had a polluted piece of land, or you had an old energy inefficient building, and to be able to make it compete with other new raw, new development, you had to make some sweeteners. That's where it started, and then it sort of blossomed into any business person felt like they could go from community to community within Minnesota, within state to state across the country, and felt like they would be a fool if they didn't get some sweetener out of government to do what they intended to do. And I'm wondering if we might be at the start of that, where we're going to start a regional competition within Minnesota, and companies will go from one to another of these 20 funds to see who will give them the best deal. And so we'll increase that internal tension within Minnesota, and that ultimately the end result will be all 50 states have this, and we've just all 50 states have reduced their revenue base for businesses that would have emerged naturally out of the human nature of people who have creative ideas who want to get them to market and want to make money.
Madam Chair, Senator Loeffler, Mark can speak to this as well, but I think the whole idea of having 20 regional funds is that this is a benefit we thought the entire state can both take advantage of, and that there's sometimes a metro-centric fixation when it comes to, you know, venture capital. That's all happening in the metro area. That's where the medical device companies are. That's where the real activity is coming. I think that's a fiction, and so we thought it was important to have a regional footprint, a statewide footprint. And different investment funds will have different expertise for different parts of the state. You know, one might have an expertise in manufacturing that's more adaptable to rural Minnesota. One might have an emphasis in biomedical, which is more maybe metro or Rochester or something. So I think it was important that this be a statewide benefit, and that these angel investment networks will sprout up, and when they see this incentive, you know, come forward with unique expertise in each one. I don't know about the competition aspect of it. I think each will have their niche. We also already have these investment funds throughout the state, the McKnight funds. There's seven or eight of them throughout the state. And do they compete a little bit, maybe? But I think they each bring a core competency that represents their region. And there are differences among the state. Some are manufacturing centers, some are, you know, device centers. So I think that was the thought, and Mark may want to elaborate on that a little bit, but that was kind of the thought about this. They did not want this to be a metro-centric proposal where all the capital flows into the metro area under this proposal. They wanted all the entire state to benefit from it.
Mr. Loftus and members, we are trying to get through this. Mr. Loftus.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I respect the question about regional competition because we deal with it all the time, and communities competing right over development. This, however, is a program aimed at generating capital within those regions, helping people who have funds, who have done well for themselves, to invest in businesses in their own area. And at the same time, we also allow, and as we've seen the rainforest programs evolve, those funds have also invested, have worked together to invest in companies where they, as they discovered, syndicate projects throughout the funds, and they invest together in deals that might require more capital. So I understand the question about competition. We, as the commissioner said, we're trying to make sure that we, every corner of the state where there are these are business opportunities as well as potential investment, that doesn't all flow to the metro area.
Okay, follow up. Just to follow up, Madam Chair, and first of all, I should note that the metro area never got one of the McKnight initiative funds, and quite honestly, I've been very jealous because I've seen some really wonderful things happen out of those efforts in greater Minnesota, and there's nothing comparable in the metro area to do that. And I'd say actually in many ways I feel like the metro area is compromised in terms of its ability to work on these sorts of things compared to greater Minnesota. There's a greater sense of cohesiveness and actually some extra tools available in other areas. So I think be careful about even that. But I think there's an issue that we need to look at that's broader than that, just about how much competition do we want to spur within our state and how much we want people to work together.
Commissioner, we've done 3 pages in 3 days. We have 23 pages to go. We are not having 23 more hearings on the governor's budget proposal, which is only on the revenue part of the governor's budget proposal. So, but we do want members who the list is still here, who continue on both sides of the aisle to have a lot of issues related to these changes in the you know, the governor's whole package is sort of tax cuts for businesses. So I'm just trying to think through getting through all of this, because we are going to have you come back again, and we're just going to keep on doing that until people feel like they have all the answers they need. But I guess what I'd like to say is, you know, we've become quite a good debating society in here, and it's nice because people kind of hone their skills for the floor on both sides of the aisle. It's helpful. It helps people get a little more succinct, and they try things out and they don't work, so then they don't repeat them. And on both sides of the aisle, they, you know, kind of, well, that one seemed to get some play. I'll repeat that later. And that's fine, and we're all good at that, and that's what we should keep doing. But I do want to just finish with who we've got on the list here and get through just the tax benefits for business, and then we have testifiers who sat here yesterday, and they are going to be heard today. So we, one way or another, we're going to get those people up to the microphone so the public can tell us what they think. And what I would like is people who are not paid to be here first. And we have some people who are not paid to be here. We would like to hear from them. And then we can go into the lobbying community, and then we'll adjourn. And then we'll have you back to do the property taxes. And then we'll hear at that time. So if there are city groups, county groups are here to testify on all those parts of the governor's budget, we're not going to even get to that today. If you are a regular citizen who was here for all the property tax aid and credit changes, we'll take your testimony today so you don't have to come back. So if that's why you're here, we want to hear from you. So Les Murphy Dabney, then we're going to finish with the commission, and we're going to go to the public. So
thank,
Les.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of time, I'm not going to pass up some calls. In the interest of time, I'm not going to ask for an answer for you today, but it does relate to, based on what we've been talking about, what we talked about last time related to corporate franchise tax, and also these proposals now that we see for the credits, aids and credits, which really concerns me, because I see these aids and credits as kind of a dessert, where we haven't finished our beans. Actually, I'll call it the Pink Floyd Amendment, the how can you have any pudding when you don't eat your meat question from the end of Real Neato Education, for those who are unfamiliar. But I asked, Ms. Taplin was good enough to put together a list of what I said, when do we get the largest share of revenues out of the corporate franchise tax, or prior to that, corporate income tax, because I suspected that once upon a time they were more than 7% of general fund revenues. And where did they put the money? Where are they hiding the money is my question, because as we've seen, incomes for the top quintile of income earners have increased dramatically over the same period of time from 1962, when estimated, as we have the best information we have, estimated general fund revenues, they were at 12%, and they've been slowly shrinking all the way down to now where we're sitting at about 7%. So my question for you is, which you don't have to provide an answer for today, but I would like your opinion on some point, is where's the money going, and how are we going to make up for that revenue in other tax sources? And it's not just a rhetorical question I would like to answer at some point, just not today. Thank you,
okay,
Madam Chair.
So Commissioner Rep. Les has a request, and you can provide it to the whole committee, Representative or Commissioner.
And Madam Chair, Rep. Les, we will provide that. One thing Dr. Wilson has done, he's provided me with a sheet that shows what corporate revenues have done is percent of state and local revenues, which he thinks is a better measurement, because we're always changing the definition of general fund. We're taking sales tax for motor vehicles out, we're putting something else in. So he thought a more constant definition would be as a percentage of state and local revenues. And we have that, and we can elaborate on your question in future time, for sure.
Okay, thank you. And so we've got Representative Dietrich's request and Representative Les's, which if it's all right with Representative Dietrich and Representative Les, we'll ask the commissioner to provide it for the entire committee. And I think while we're on it, Representative Gardner has a request as well. So Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you could let us know if the department has given any thought on LGA in the way you did with county program aid, where you're cutting, we need to cut, but they're also sort of giving a credit if they consolidate human services operations. And I'd be curious if your staff has given any thought for how to use a kind of a carrot approach with LGA also to get cities like in the suburbs where I am, where it's just one big jigsaw puzzle of municipalities who all do the same thing, to try and encourage them to share services and do things smarter.
Right. Okay, any other requests? Now three from members who want the commissioner to come back with more information, since they're coming back anyhow. Anybody else? Okay, so we've got three requests there that have been provided to the full committee. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and mine is a question for information and not to refine my debating points. So I'm looking at the Small Business Investment Tax Credit and the mechanics around that. And as I read it, it's $38 million in a tax credit, two insurance companies for early stage investment, and a capital company that would invest in a small business, correct?
Correct.
So I'm interested in why the insurance company to the capital company to the small business, and if you can help me understand if there are laws in place or barriers in place that would disallow an insurance company to make that investment currently.
Madam Chair, representative, there are no impediments at this point for them to make those investments. At this point, they're probably not making those investments based on a return on investment sort of determination. We're hopeful that providing a tax credit at 60% will change that calculus. And they'll say, well, that doesn't make sense to invest in that small business, that maybe that more risky venture. So it's really just determining what your tipping point is to make them want to invest. I mean, Mark, I don't know of any impediments to them making those sort of investments.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we learned this week that currently at least three Minnesota companies that have premium tax liability in other states do make these kinds of investments where they have such a program. Securian or Minnesota Life, St. Paul Travelers, and Federated are all, where this program exists, are making those investments. So it certainly is allowable.
Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up. Do you think it's important to help the insurance companies with these investments because of the current economic climate, or do you think it is a policy that we would want to enact because other states are doing it and we want to compete?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, it's certainly the latter, and it's not about giving the insurance companies a windfall or a special tax credit or anything. It's really about ultimately job creation and trying to compete in a global economy. And these tools are out there. And in an ideal world, I concur a lot with Madam Chair, that in an ideal world, if we were constructing a tax code from the bottom up, a lot of these credits and deductions probably wouldn't be necessary, wouldn't be optimal. But the reality is, that's not the world we operate in. We don't operate in an ivory tower. We don't operate in an economic textbook. Other states, other jurisdictions, other countries have tools like this, like, as you know. And we can't unilaterally disarm ourselves. So this is really an effort to compete, and this is a tool that has been successful in other states, and we want to adapt.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dabney, Denise Lynn.
Madam Chair, I've got a lot more I could say about this topic, but I'm hoping you're giving me a hearing on my angel investor tax credit, so I'll try to keep it short and spend.
I think you're getting it right now.
I think I am. I think I will just focus in on the budget deficit for a moment, and I think there's some in the room who hope that we solve it entirely through budget cuts, and I don't think we're going to do that. And there may be, although I doubt, that there are some in the room who hope that we solve it entirely by revenue increases, and I'm confident we're not going to do that. We have reason to hope that we'll solve a piece of it through the assistance of the Obama administration and the Recovery Act. I think the piece that's being placed here on the table is a strategy to help us grow out of the deficit as well, and to spark investment in Minnesota and spark job creation. And I think we need all four of those strategies at play as this committee and this legislature struggles with solving this budget deficit and positioning Minnesota to better grow going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Houston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would just like to compliment the Commissioner, and I think it's a great program. I think it's the absolute direction we need to be going. The question I have is related to the kind of the cap on income. It's got to be less than $2 million growth income at sales. And then you got another statement in here, fewer than 100 employees. $2 million in sales is not a very big number. I mean, there's a lot of small businesses in my town that have $4 to $6 million in sales and have 30 employees. And I guess I'm wondering, it seems like kind of a disconnect there. I mean, if you got 100 employees and you're making $2 million or less, that's $20,000 an employee. I'm not sure that's the kind of jobs we really want to be pushing to keep creating. You know, I guess so. So I just, could you comment on that?
Sure.
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, you know, we had a lot of discussion about targeting this tax credit and these investments, and we tried to find, you know, a pretty good proxy for what is a small business. We borrowed some definitions from other programs around the state that have used this definition. I wouldn't say we're necessarily wedded to this definition, but our intent is clear. We want to target this benefit, this investment, at smaller businesses. And whether the $2 million in sales, 100 employees is the right proxy for that, I think we're open to that debate. But I think it really was, we wanted to target this at smaller businesses. Because that we've identified as that where the true need resides. So now we're open. If there's another definition out there that meets this purpose, that surgically targets this benefit at small businesses, we're open to that. Mark has probably done more due diligence on this than I have, but we've had a lot of discussion on how to target this.
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, 97% of all the companies in the state, by number, have fewer than 100 employees. And I don't have the number of $2 million in gross revenue, but within the industry of the early stage capital, especially there, we are trying to focus on the smaller companies. The insurance company part of program is probably more aimed at a little later stage, but still pre-venture. So, as Mr. said, we are open to working on the definition to make it work.
Okay. Commissioner, we have good lips left to cover in leaving time for public testimony. Green Job D, capital equipment upfront exemption, Section 179 expensing, capital gains exemption. Those four we haven't got into yet, and they are the continuation of the business tax cut.
Right.
You think you can do that in 5 minutes so the public can speak?
Madam Chair, I know I can.
Okay, hang on a minute. Representative Coles wants longer.
No, I want the public there.
Well,
I'm afraid that we can't do this in 5 minutes, and it's not fair to people who've been here 2 days.
Well, I only see about three people who aren't paid to be here, so we can we can go right to them right
now.
I'm not too concerned about
you're
the
charge,
people.
Madam Chair, that's
well,
fine.
You know, there's a lot of people who are employed to be here every day, and they're here every day. So we can go right to the public and cut the commissioner off and not let him finish what else the governor is proposing in business tax cuts. Does anyone else have a thought on that? I'm open to whatever the committee wants to do here. Commissioner, what would you like to do? I guess I'll take up Representative Coles. We'll go to the public. We'll take you guys away from the mics. We're not going to get to all your business tax cuts, and we'll take the public.
I can come back at any time, then.
Okay, so that's okay. Well, you're going to. Thank you, and please don't leave, because we want to hear from, first of all, people who are not lobbying an issue before the tax committee this year. Is there anyone in that category who would like to step forward? Please. Yes. And this gentleman who I had a chance to meet at the end of the tax committee was here yesterday. So we really apologize that we didn't get you up before. And I did not catch your name, so if you can tell us your name for the tape, we're interested. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim Youth. I'm Joe Taxpayer. I represent my family in the state of Minnesota. I was born in Minnesota many, many moons ago, grew up in California, and moved back here 31 years ago. So I've been here for a while in the state of Minnesota. I want to read two sentences out of a document that brings us all here together. It's called the Constitution of Minnesota. It was established October 13th in 1857. The preamble clearly states, "We the people of the state of Minnesota, grateful to God for our civil and religious liberty, and desiring to perpetuate its blessings and to secure the same for ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish its constitution." Article 1 of the Bill of Rights reads, "The object of government. Government is instituted for the security, benefit, and protection of the people, in whom all political power is inherent." The political power is inherent in the people. I just want to remind this body of that today. "Together with the right of the people to alter, modify, and reform government whenever required by the public good." Just a quick note on that. There's a lot of unhappy residents of Minnesota out there, and they're watching. Government only consumes and competes with private sector and never produces. Every $1 billion that the state of Minnesota takes out of the economy is $200 for every man, woman, and child in the state. That's just for consideration to consider. Remember, you got a $16 billion budget, that's $3,200 per person. Government has a good function. It has various constitutional mandates and most of the government's responsibility is to facilitate between business and families and whatever else. It's not its job is not to dominate and control. As of Monday, 680 bills have been introduced into this legislature. Light rail to the north, to the east, and to the south have been introduced. Universal drugs, universal medical services, hundreds of millions of dollars in bonding for all kinds of things, including functions that should fall under the new constitutional amendment. When I look at that list and see all the different bills that are being passed, I don't see the urgency in the bills that are being introduced with the concept that we're $4, 5, 6, 7 billion in the hole in this next biennium. We have an economic tsunami coming to the state and to the nation. Our U.S. Treasury, our Federal Reserve, and our federal government are doing some things in this with our currency and our economy that I don't see a solution for. Just yesterday, Paulson. Am I right with the Paulson? Stagner proposed $2 trillion more for another program to hopefully stimulate the economy. So we're up to $11 trillion in the last 18 months between those three groups of people committing to trying to fix our economy, which isn't getting fixed. I don't know if anybody's seen the movie Deep Impact, with a daughter standing on the beach at the end of the movie and this 1,000-foot tsunami's coming to hit him, and the daughter's got out, his dad's got his arms around the daughter, and she says to her dad, "Dad, I'm scared." We ought to be. All of us sitting in this room ought to be scared. Everybody at the state capitol ought to be seriously, seriously scared. Taxes, which is basically this commission, or this group. Taxes only reflect spending demands from the state capitol. I heard yesterday some testimony about that you guys generate revenue but you got to understand something. The primary issue of why you raise taxes is because spending decisions that are made across the street. You guys don't make those decisions in this body. You just respond to the spending that goes on across the street. So each dollar you take out of this wallet right here, I don't get back. I can't go to the movies with it. I can't buy gas. I can't take my kids to the show or down the street or put them in soccer games because you guys take the dollar from me. I want you to remember that when you're spending my money. Education. Yesterday, there was a lot of frills, doomsday scenarios given, like no textbooks, chairs, desks in classrooms, 40 kids to a classroom. At current spending levels, that's $520,000 in a classroom each year being spent. I want to know, if the state is spending $520,000 in a classroom, why they don't have books, chairs, desks, and maybe 5 teachers. That's a lot of money to be going into one classroom for school. I believe the correct population in a classroom in the state is average of 24. That's $312,000 a year. $312,000 is still a lot of money. And I want to know where it's going. Nobody can explain to me. I've been around here for 6 weeks asking questions, and nobody can really explain to me where all that money is going. And education wants another, $3,000 per student? A 30% increase? Like I said, I've lived in Minnesota for 31 years, and I've watched the news, listened to the news, watched this capital. I've never heard education come here and say, "I had enough. We have enough money." For 31 years I've lived in Minnesota, they said they want more money. Education seems to me like a sumo wrestler at a taxpayer's buffet with no limits and no accountability. That's me, the consumer. That's me, the taxpayer out there telling me how I see it. And I got a lot of people all across the state that feel the same way. Spending priorities. We're spending $5,000 per smart board in the state. And my understanding is it's a statewide project. So it was mentioned yesterday that Stillwater finally bought dictionaries that has the word computer in it. And why are we spending $5,000 per smart board if we can't afford books in a dictionary? Priority spendings are wrong, folks. Something is seriously, seriously wrong. And this is just an education. This whole thing goes across the state, all the state functions. House File 2, it changes formulas. Maybe we need to change funding formulas. I have no problems as a Joe taxpayer with changing funding formulas to make sure everybody gets paid. But when they want 30% more included in that with no accountability, I have some serious problems with paying the bills for that stuff. Let's see, one more item across the board. I suggest make life simple across the board, even spending cuts for all departments. I've been around here and I've asked and asked and asked, and nobody will touch education. Beyond me, why? It's still part of state government, and it still has to have accountability. One more question, and maybe the commissioner can answer this. In page 72 of the governor's consolidated fund report is Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund that's been set up. There's four funds that were set up. In here, under receivables, there's a line that says 2009 governor's recommended for capital equipment sales, which I believe we were talking about yesterday or today. Another line that says sales tax refunds. Now, you can look at it for yourself, but if I'm wrong, I apologize. If I'm right, shame on us. But this is a constitutional amendment. It appears to me that money is being taken from the constitutional fund to help support these tax refunds. Now, if I'm wrong, like I said, I apologize. But this is how it looks to me. And so I'd like somebody to explain that to me if that's what it is, because all four of these funds are being siphoned. So I just want somebody to clarify that to me today so I know, because I'm never ready to report to my constituents about this in my neighborhood, what's going on at State Capitol. Thank you very, very, very much for your time. Like I said, there's nobody paying me to do this except my own wallet, so thank you very much.
Mr. Youth, I really appreciate you being here, and I really want to apologize again that you were here yesterday, and we did not know that, and you're really committed that you stayed, and I really appreciate that. I think we all heard the passion in your voice, and it was important. It's important for us to hear that, because everybody is in a whole bunch of pain. No matter what our philosophical perspective is and political around here. So really do appreciate you taking the time to talk to all of us. I do want to get an answer for you on that last part from Mr. Michael. So I think you'll find that is not the what the voters passed being moved there, but there's an interaction with the sales tax that affects this committee. So I have Mr. Michael describe that. But I know that was just a small part of your testimony. I want you to know that we hear you on all the other things. But just to get an answer, it'll help the committee understand the issue there as well. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this all relates to the capital equipment exemption, as you know, given a governor's budget proposal, that essentially, although these purchases by businesses are exempt from tax, they're required by law to pay the tax up front, and then a refund is paid to them upon application later. And so, for the sales tax that's dedicated to a special fund, the money comes into the fund, but then the portion of the tax that's attributable to that dedicated tax gets paid out of the fund as a refund. So in fact, if the legislature were to enact the governor's proposal providing just the standard upfront sales tax exemption, those lines on that fund, as that the witness pointed out, would eventually go away, because you wouldn't be paying those refunds. You would not be collecting the revenue, putting it in the fund, and then paying refunds out of that fund to the taxpayers.
Questions on that to everyone? Okay, great. And again, thank you so much, Mr. Hughes. Further testifiers? Please, yes, welcome. Did you sit here yesterday, too?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's okay. I love coming down.
Well, we want you to keep coming back.
Well,
can you give us your name for the tape?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Nick Quaid, Ramsey County Conservation Supervisor, just recently elected.
Congratulations.
Thank you. No, I love coming down here. The spirit of debate is wonderful. Yesterday inspired me. I was up late last night. I mean, really, yesterday was great, because it was a debate about what we ought to be doing here between Representative Rukavinia and Garofalo. That was wonderful. But I'm quite certain it's going to get fairly interesting here in the next few months. But I apologize. I have a suit, but I was a little gluttonous over the holidays, so I can't fit into it. But anyways, otherwise I would have worn a suit and tie. But I've been down here now since, we've been coming down here now for several months, and I'm getting to know the state and the budget process and et cetera. I'm sure a few of you maybe have seen me running around. But nonetheless, I wanted to talk about preparing for the future. And this committee obviously has a huge role in that, being as though the incredible challenges that we face with the state. First of all, I spent a lot of my time browsing through the incredible crisis that we're in. And I've been doing it now for a couple of years, and I've anticipated this coming before everybody, you know, everybody thought I was crazy in the early 2008, and then, of course, now it's a reality. But I think we need to expect nothing from the federal government, and we need, as a state, to prepare and take care of our house here. Because the federal government, in my humble opinion, has completely lost it. Out of control. And I could list a numerous of things. And it comes to everything from the Treasury to the privately owned and controlled Federal Reserve to the executive branch to Congress. So I think we need to take care of our house here at home. Now, what's interesting was I was looking at what happened last session as to kind of gauge where we are at in this session. And what was interesting was I sat through the testimony from the State Budget Trends Commission, which I found fairly interesting. The in quote on page 24, the current deficit of $4.8 billion that the state is facing for the next biennium. First, the current deficit includes $946 million shortfall for the current biennium that was left unsolved at the end of 2009 legislative session. That's stunning. We can't be doing that anymore. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And I apologize, but I just think that we need to look forward instead of pushing stuff on. I mean, come on, everybody knew that things were going to get bad. And it says right here in the report that we pushed it over. And that's included in the $4.8 billion deficit, is almost $1 billion. So now where are we at? We've got the governor's budget, and that's what we're all talking about right here, because we don't have another budget to look at, another recommendation at least yet. And even in the governor's budget, it anticipates that in biennium 12 and 13, a $2.5 billion deficit. I mean, it's just out of control. When we so in my head, it's starting to expand and I'm starting to get really worried here, you know. And one of the things that from this commission that I really think everybody needs to pay attention to is page 27, and a real significant paragraph from this study. The findings of this report indicate that our state's current spending and revenue trends are simply unsustainable. Until there are significant changes in public expectations, and that comes from you going back to your constituents and trying to get reelected, which, of course, 95% of incumbents did. State officials will repeatedly scramble to balance the budget, but will not have the time or the resources to address the state's competitive position and seek opportunities for future prosperity. And as we look into the future, and I've, you know, tried to talk to several lawmakers, and it's extremely difficult, but we've got a huge demographic switch that's coming up here that's going to have a fiscal, some call it a fiscal tsunami. Coming. But also in this budget, since we're in the tax committee, one of the things that recommended was bonding for $1 billion to pay, I think it's $936 million in debt service. So essentially we're taking out a Visa card to pay off our American Express card. I mean, that's just ludicrous. And that's a tax, because I've got the charts. I sat in on Commissioner Hansen's testimony. $640 million we're going to pay over the course of 20 years so that we can take care of our debt service for 1 year? Well, we can't be doing that. That's a tax. $640 million, that's a tax. We're going to have to pay that in interest over the course of that time, and we can't be doing that. I'm sure if I were going down to everybody's local drinking hole and you talk to your average citizen, you say, hey, guess what the state's doing? I'm probably sure you can't find a single person in that room who'll say, oh, that's a great idea, you know, because it's a temporary solution. And I think we all know that debt service is continuously rising, and if we do this, that's going to rise even more. And I was researching tax cuts for businesses. I spent a couple hours just, you know, Googling, trying to find some studies. And, you know, logically that sounds great. I mean, we're the second highest corporate tax rate in the country, next to, I think, Pennsylvania's number one. But at the same time, one of my random thoughts that I wrote down is I would like to recommend tax cuts for businesses because you think that would spur job growth, but we can't afford them. We got no money. We're broke. You take a tax cut, somehow or another, you're going to have to fill that with revenue. So I think, and of course, yesterday I sat through Senator Marty's presentation on the universal health care, which, I mean, he can't even come up with a figure on that one. So, I mean, in terms of revenue costs, he couldn't even come up with one. So, and then, of course, I sat in K-12 education, and Representative Greiling, she wanted, billions more in education. And at the same time, I was reading a report from former Secretary Robert Reich from the Clinton administration, served Secretary of Labor from 93 to 97. He said, quote, "We cannot assume, however, that these sorts of public investments will grow the economy enough to reduce the relation and size of future debt." So even he said, well, yeah, all these studies over here that say, of course, we need to invest in education and health care and et cetera. But he said it's even the Secretary of the former Secretary of Labor said, well, that's uncertain as well. And so I know we face a lot of challenges coming up here. And the Center on Budget and Policy and Priority says that at least 39 states looking ahead anticipate deficits for fiscal year 2010 and beyond. And of course, the governor's budget says we've got, 12 and 13, we've got $2.5 billion. And that's going to rise. I read through the federal stimulus, the House's version. The Senate is so fresh, I haven't had a chance to go through the 700 pages. But in the House version, I could only come up with $81 billion that would directly affect the GDP. $81 billion out of $800 billion that would generally reflect the GDP. So we've got some serious decisions to make. And the only thing that I can honestly come up with is, let's cut some spending. Let's just do it. Let's just take the deficit that we have and cut across the board and tighten our belts. Families are doing that across the state. And I know a lot of people go around and it's politically feasible that, I got to get elected, so I got to go and promise people things. But hey, let's be responsible, because we got to prepare ourselves. And if we don't, we're going to continuously push on stuff into the future, and then we're going to end up looking one day at a problem that is so huge and so big, and we're going to ask ourselves, geez, why didn't we take care of this earlier before? And with the rate that local government is expanding, to have a contraction wouldn't necessarily be that bad. Government never voluntarily reduces itself in size. It never does. But these are extraordinary circumstances, and I think from a layman's view of the situations that we face, I think it wouldn't necessarily be a bad idea to say, hey, guess what? I'm sorry, guys, citizens, we got to tighten our belts. We got to get our house in order. And so I don't know. That's just what I was thinking about, and I appreciate you guys allowing the opportunity for me to testify. And I really, it's going to be a tough couple months, and I my heart's with you guys, because you guys got tough decisions to make. And at this point, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat or an Independent, we're all in this boat together, because I ain't moving from this state. I love this state. So I just wanted to thank you guys, and thanks again.
Thank you so much, Mr. Quaid, and members. We have one more person who's been waiting from the public, and if everyone can hang on, I know we end at noon, but we would like to hear from that person so they don't have to come back again. So please, welcome to the committee. Yes, please. But Mr. Quaid, as he's coming up, I do want to tell you, you're absolutely, I think you hit it right. The partisan thing doesn't matter. We're in it together. Tough times. It's going to be rough, and we really appreciate that people like you are moving around through all these committees, trying to take it all in. It's very difficult, so I hope you will speak to us again yet this year, because it's going to get a little rougher. So thank you, Mr. Quaid. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. My name is Mike Downing. I'm chair of the East Metro Region of the Minnesota Senior Federation, and I did have the opportunity to briefly speak to the Property Tax Committee, and I will I wanted to address this group on behalf of the retired seniors in the state and a lot here in the metro area. As a retired senior myself, I'm young retiree, but I'm representing many people that are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s that have been in their homes for 30, 40, and 50 years. Property taxes are becoming a real burden for the retired seniors to be able to stay in their homes. Property taxes, if you look at many of the programs and for aging policy, it is in the state's best interest to keep seniors in their homes for as long as they can physically and mentally be self-sufficient in their homes. It costs the state much more money if they are forced out of their homes. And many of our seniors are paying 10, 20, 30, and we do have people in our membership that are paying 40% of their income on property taxes. Now you say, ask the question, how can this be? The 2007 tax incentive study shows for the full state, the average income that people pay in property taxes is 1.8%. The highest income decile pay only 0.4% of their income on property taxes. The lowest income decile are paying 2.5%. So how can it be that people are paying, you know, as retired seniors are paying 10, 20, 30, and 40%? We don't have the data, and one of the requests I have of this committee today and to the Department of Revenue is on March 1st, the VAWT database will be available, and we would humbly request that the VAWT database, do some data dredging and look at the percent of income people are paying in property taxes based on the age of the individual and the length of time the person has been in their homes. We believe that that will give this committee and Representative Marquardt's committee information to make informed decisions, because we believe that hidden within the average, we do have a subgroup of people that are paying 10, 20, 30, and 40% of their income on property taxes. And that subgroup are the retired seniors and the people that have been in their homes for 30, 40, and 50 years. As I said, I'm a young retiree. I've been in the home for 35 years. I'm currently paying 12% of my income on property taxes. And there's going to be a point in time where I'm going to be forced out of my retirement home. The home that I had planned to entertain my grandchildren in, the home that I had hoped to stay in for a long period of time. But with the property taxes occurring in White Bear Lake right now, 15% growth last year, 22% growth this year, there's a point in time where I'm going to have to move out of that home. And I'm not just one individual. Many seniors in the Minnesota Senior Federation are forced into that same situation. So we're going to come back to the Representative Marquardt's committee with specific proposals. We're going to come back to this committee and talk about some possibilities. But one thing that I know that Representative Gardner has done in the past and Representative Broad has done in the past is have some form of a limit, and I know many people around this this table may not agree with the limit, but you pick your own number, because every other tax we have in the state of Minnesota has a limit. Sales tax, whether it's 6.5% up to 7.18, 7 1/8, or income tax has a limit. We're just asking this group to identify what is the limit that you want to put for people to pay of their income on property taxes. So again, we'd ask that the VAWT database be looked at so we can help you identify subgroups that are hurting very, very bad. We believe the retired seniors are one, and help us with our constituents to be able to stay in their homes for as long as they can humanly possible stay in their homes. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Downing. We really appreciate it. We are going to hear the Voss database in March, member, so we'll be talking about it then. With that, we are adjourned.